The Nine Lives of Montezuma by Michael Morpurgo. And this is his third life. It was not to be an easy transition from the farmyard to the house. Growing up, it seemed, imposed certain restrictions that Montezuma found difficult to accept. He had to learn, for instance, not to jump up on the kitchen table to lick the plates, not to yowl around the table, and not to be inside when he should have been outside. Every night, he was obliged to go out, whatever the weather. When it was raining hard, he would hide in amongst the chair legs or crawl inside the kitchen cupboard under the sink in an attempt to avoid eviction, but it did him no good. His expulsion might be postponed for a few moments, but when it came, it was all the more abrupt and uncomfortable. On several occasions, the kitten stole away to explore the bedrooms upstairs, and once he squeezed into the pantry where all the good smells came from. But he found the rule of law was consistent and merciless. Each time he transgressed, the punishment was swift and sharp. He was chased out and banished until time healed the offence and he was forgiven again. Gradually, he was learning. He was learning all the rules and regulations, the boundaries and codes, and more he found it expedient to keep inside the law, ostensibly at any rate. The family all agreed that Montezuma was beginning to conform to their idea of an acceptable cat, and Matthew congratulated himself upon this miraculous conversion. Even Matthew's father was beginning to admit, albeit begrudgingly, that the kitten was losing his farmyard manners. This was just the impression Montezuma wished to convey. He had merely learnt the wisdom of cunning, of guerrilla warfare, as opposed to open battle. He was developing a secret weapon that would ensure the good life, and that weapon was guile. Now he would wait until the coast was quite clear before he committed his crimes. He recognised that previously his crimes of passion and greed had led to an early detection and dire punishment, so now he turned to premeditated crime, meticulously planned and executed. Now he would sleep under beds and not on top of them. Now he stole from the kitchen table only when the house was deserted and the door wide open for a quick escape. The efficient criminal must understand the law and then learn how best to avoid being caught. Montezuma might have continued all his life as a habitual outlaw had he not tangled that fateful afternoon with the tin of baked beans left behind on the kitchen table. He would never even have seen the tin if the great white cockerel had not chased him away from the flower beds where he had been playing quite innocently among the snapdragons. The cockerel, a vicious light Sussex with a predatory beak and a flaming comb, had clearly decided that the kitten was a threat to his cackle of hens that were mining for worms in the shrubbery behind the flower bed. He crowed noisily, but the kitten paid him no attention, so he strutted purposefully towards him, wings flapping and neck feathers fluffed out, and still the kitten appeared not to notice him, and so the cockerel ran the last few feet, his neck outstretched, and pecked the kitten just above his tail. Montezuma knew better than to mix it with an angry cockerel, so he beat a retreat, hissing and spitting back at the cockerel from a safe distance. By the back door, he turned again to arch his back in a final gesture of indignation. But the cockerel had forgotten him and was feeding with his hens in the flower bed. It was then that Montezuma spied the green tin standing like a beckoning beacon on the kitchen table. Tins, he knew from delving into dustbins, were always worth further investigation. Everyone was out of the house. That much he was sure of, because he had watched all three of them setting off down the farm track towards the sheep fields. They were gone, and someone had left the door wide open. It was an invitation not to be refused. With a final look around, he stole into the kitchen, jumped onto the chair by the stove, and then from the chair onto the table. He was alone with the green tin, and one look told him that the tin was far from empty. Montezuma licked the sides clean first before pushing his head further in so that he could eat his way down towards the bottom of the tin. It was a delectable feast, and he did not hurry it. Several times he came up for air to lick his whiskers and to listen out for footsteps before plunging his head in once again. There was one layer of beans covered in sauce on the bottom that he still could not reach, and just a few, but Montezuma had to have them. Determined not to waste anything, he forced his head down until the tin felt tight around his neck, and then he wrapped his tongue around the last of the beans and licked the tin clean. He was searching in every corner now for the last traces of the tomato sauce and was licking around for the last time in case he had left any behind, satisfied yet disappointed that the baked bean orgy was over. Montezuma called it a day and pulled his head out. It might be better to say that he tried to pull his head out, because try as he might, his head would not be pulled free. Each time he tried to jerk his head away, the tin stayed with it. He used his front paws in an attempt to anchor the tin on the table, but he could not grip sufficiently for the tin to hold as he pulled his head once again in an attempt to break free. Panic was setting in by now. Each attempt that failed only increased his terror. It was becoming hot inside the tin, and he found the air more and more difficult to breathe, and there didn't seem to be enough of it, and he sensed that time was running out, and he whipped over onto his back and with his front paws tried to prise the tin off his head. He twisted this way and that in a frantic effort, scrabbling at the rim of the tin with his claws, but the tin was stuck fast. Within a few minutes, he had lost the notion of his position on the table and stepped out into mid-air, falling heavily on the corner of the chair before hitting the floor. He landed badly on his side, and when he finally found his feet again, he was totally disorientated. Like a blind man, he staggered around the kitchen, into cupboards and chair legs, and tripping over bowls and brooms until he fell down the back doorstep and found himself in the cobbled yard outside. Montezuma came out into the sun by the water tank and the tin can riveted over his face. He called out in his fear as loudly as he could, and this attracted the attention of the white cockerel and his hens. And with an hysterical squawking, they scattered in all directions, leaving Montezuma alone on the cobbles, wandering in aimless circles and yowling pitifully. Every few moments he stopped and tried again to loosen the tin. But he had tried every way he could think of, and it was all to no avail. He was weakening all the time, and each effort to free himself was more feeble than the one before. Matthew and his parents had left the house in a hurry to pick out one of the ewes that looked unwell, and Matthew had thought it might be Black Udder, and it needed three of them to catch her to be sure. He had been proved right, and they had treated the ewe before returning home. And as they came into the yard, all three saw the kitten at the same time walking drunkenly towards them like some feline Ned Kelly. Matthew reached him first and held him fast while his father pulled on the tin. "Mind his neck," Matthew shouted. "You'll break his neck." "He'll suffocate if he stays like this," his father said. "Suffocated, broken necks all the same. You hold him tight. Mum, you run and fetch some of that liquid soap. Might help to loosen it." Montezuma was only semi-conscious now, and so fought instinctively against the hands that held him. His eyes felt as if they would burst in his head, and he was totally consumed by his terror. "Easy, Monty," said Matthew, releasing a hand to stroke the kitten. "Easy, you'll be all right. We'll have it off in no time, you'll see." The kitten relaxed, momentarily calmed, only to start up again, slashing his claws wildly with renewed viciousness. The soap arrived, and within seconds, Matthew's mother had dribbled in enough so that the tin could be turned. Matthew clutched the kitten firmly, gathering all the legs securely together, while his father tried now to unscrew the tin from the head. And this time it came away easily in his hand. For just a second, Montezuma remained still in Matthew's hands, his eyes screwed up against the light, taking the fresh air deep into his lungs. Then he dug his claws in and sprang free. He ran as he had never run, going nowhere in particular, just away. He sprinted under the iron gate that led to the farmyard, squeezed through the sheep netting and out into the meadow beyond. And there, the trunk of the old beech tree loomed up in front of him. And he climbed it because it was there, and because to go up was to get away. And he climbed until he could climb no longer, until he ran out of tree. Matthew followed and came through into the farmyard only just in time to catch sight of the kitten scaling the sheer straight trunk of the tree. He watched, shielding his eyes against the sun, as Montezuma crawled out onto an upper branch, finally coming to rest some 30 feet above the duck pond. "Where the devil's he gone now?" said his father, still holding the baked bean tin in his hand. "He's up there," said Matthew, frightened half to death. "Matthew," his mother said, "I haven't used baked beans in weeks. Have you been at my tins again?" "I was hungry," Matthew admitted. "I just had a few, that's all." "Gad, you're a baked bean fanatic," said his father, "and you've been told often enough about tidying up after yourself. It's your fault, my lad. Could have killed that kitten, you know." "Didn't know you cared," said Matthew. "Don't you start, you two," said Matthew's mother. "There's poor Monty stuck up a tree, so don't start. We've got to get him down. He won't come down on his own, not from that height." "I'll go up after him," said Matthew. "You can't go all the way up there," his mother said. "What happens if you fall?" "He won't fall," said Matthew's father. "He'll be all right. He's spent most of his life climbing trees. Climbs like a monkey. He'll be all right." Matthew felt less confident as he began the climb. The bark was slippery from the previous day's rain, and the higher he climbed, the more wind there seemed to be. He climbed carefully, securing good footholds and testing each branch before he put his full weight onto it. He'd climbed the old beech often enough before, but always for fun. This was serious, and he was not enjoying it. He'd lost sight of Monty now and was concentrating on the climb. And from below, his father kept shouting up detailed instructions about how he would do it if he were up there, about grip and balance. And his mother kept up a chorus of, "Oh, do be careful, dear, do be careful." He found Montezuma crouching at the end of a long tapering branch that hung out over the pond. The branch looked thick enough and safe enough near the trunk, but the further away it stretched, the more fragile it looked. Matthew stood in the fork of the tree and considered all the alternatives, trying to ignore the warnings and advice from below. He could not climb out along the branch to Monty. The branch would not take his weight. He needed a net to throw out over the cat, but there was no one who could bring a net up to him. Neither his father nor his mother could climb trees. At least he had never seen them. He would have to talk the kitten back to safety. That was the only way. "Monty," he said in a soothing tone as he could manage. "It's me, Monty. You can't stay out there all day. You'll be all right now. I'll take you down. Come on then, come on. I won't hurt you." But the kitten crouched low, glued to the branch like lichen. He blinked back at Matthew, swallowing hard and mewing weakly every so often. Matthew talked on in a consoling, sympathetic tone, but he received no encouragement from Montezuma, who never moved a muscle. From down below, his father was shouting up to him, "Can't you get him down?" A question which Matthew didn't feel he could answer politely. "Fire brigade," his mother shouted up. "What about the fire brigade?" They looked so small down there in the yard. Matthew felt his parents had been getting smaller in recent years, but he had never seen them this small. "Not yet," Matthew shouted back. "Not yet. I'll try one more thing." "Do be careful, dear, do be careful," his mother's voice sounded hysterical, but then it always did whenever she shouted. Matthew held onto the branch above him and edged out onto Montezuma's branch, stepping sideways like a cautious crab. The two branches ran parallel for a few yards, and then the upper one that Matthew was holding onto came to an abrupt halt. Matthew went as far as he could and then released the upper branch, and for a moment he stood balancing with nothing to hold on to. The branch swayed underneath him, and he lowered himself carefully until he was sitting astride the branch, his hands clasping it firmly in front of him. And like this, he pulled himself along inch by inch until he knew he could go no further. And the kitten was still well out of reach. "That's far enough," his father's shouts were sharp. "No further. That's far enough. The branch won't take the weight. No further." Matthew knew he was right, but he was nearly there, and it was only a few more feet. He lay now flat along the branch, gripping behind with his feet, his hands holding on in front of him. "Come on, Monty, come on down, please. There's a good kitten. Come on now." But as he released one hand to reach out towards the cat, he lost his balance and had to grab at the branch suddenly to retrieve himself. Alarmed, the kitten backed away, lost his grip and tumbled down through the air towards the pond. Matthew watched for the splash and saw his father running down across the yard towards the pond. The ducks evacuated the pond noisily, leaving Matthew's father alone in the pond, striding waist-deep to the spot where Montezuma had fallen in. Matthew waited, closed his eyes and prayed, and when he opened them, his father was shouting up at him and laughing and holding up a dripping kitten. "Got him! He's all right! The little devil's still breathing!" And by the time Matthew had made the descent, his father was out of the pond and had pulled off his shoes. He was sitting on the ground, taking his socks off and wringing out the water. "Your father will catch his death," said Matthew's mother, who was holding on to Montezuma in a vice-like grip. "Here's your Monty," she said. "You take him, and for God's sake, hang on to him. You worry me to death, you two. First you go climbing up trees, and then he goes jumping into cold ponds at his age. You should know better. Could have killed you both, and all for what? For a kitten." "For Monty," said Matthew, rubbing the kitten dry with the tail of his shirt. "This is no ordinary cat, you know. Can you imagine my dad jumping into a pond to rescue any other cat? He's dropped plenty of kittens into this pond, but this is the first one he's ever pulled out, and that's a fact." "And the last," said his father, wriggling his wet toes, "definitely the last." Montezuma's career as a sneak thief was at an end, for the time being anyway. Certainly, half-empty tin cans held no fascination for him. Of course, there were other temptations, but he was off baked beans for life.